Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Listening to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm in studio today with Stefan Hostetter.
How you doing?
And only Stefan Hostetter.
It's just the two of us.
Well played. We missed you. Yeah, you weren't here last week, so.
No, I wasn't here 2 weeks ago. I was here.
Oh, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. They all blend together. It's yeah.
It's only our 516th show or something like that. Yeah, they kind of blur together. Okay, so without wasting any more time on goofiness, so I'm going to work backwards today because I'm slightly organized today, Stefan.
Oh, well done.
So at the end of the program, we're going to be discussing some international news, touching on a few items, including the weekly update on which oil pipeline or rig or infrastructure or train or whatever well exploded. This week it's in the Western Isles. We'll cover that. We're going to talk a little bit about the high price of avocados and how that's fueling deforestation later in the program. Scattered at some point will be some commentary about proportional representation. We haven't quite decided exactly where that's going to slip in just yet. That'll be at the end of the show. In the middle of the show, Emma Ma, who's not currently with us, although there's still a chance that she might slip in, I'm not entirely sure, was in the U.S. I believe in the U.S. Actually, I'm now blanking.
It was in the U.S.
For something called Common Bound conference, and she interviewed Nancy Nintem, who is the, and I do apologize for any native French speakers now, the Chantier de l'économie sociale, which has something to do with the social economy, although I don't know what chantier means. And she's the strategic advisor. And she's going to, I've listened to the interview a couple times now. It's a very good, quick little interview as well. Just talking about the role of the social economy, what that actually means, defining it, and both the benefits of fundamentally, foundationally supporting this type of economy and what the benefits of that would be. How to do it and why you should do it as well. That'll be in the middle of the program along with some other scattered technology news, technology science news, we'll call it, technology/science news. But starting now, Stefan, we're going to talk more local stuff. So local stuff, first one I'm going to get to right now is the calling for 11 organizations calling for a federal government review here in Canada for new energy efficiency standards. And the first takeaway from this story, which was found on DSmog blog, is also just the simple idea that we don't have one. There isn't one. There is scattered energy efficiency standards. They apply to some things in some cases. One of the areas where it's actually I don't know if I could say relative to anywhere that Canada's better, but where there's a track record of actually keeping up and updating these regulations is things like auto emissions. Right. As an area where even pre-climate change, just due to pollution, just due to air pollution, there is regular rechecking and re-updating of fuel efficiency standards and things like this. And that's a really good test case because every single time there's talk about it, most recently it was tied in with California. And it's the same story every time, isn't it, Stefan? It's people say, we want to raise the efficiency standards. Car companies go, that will raise our costs. And then they do it. And infrequently they do it and then start competing with each other to see how much farther they can go past it because they're like, well, now this is the thing. So we have to spend a bunch of money on it. So we might as well turn this into a marketing angle. Let's make it sexy to be green again while we're at this anyway. Let's run it as far as we can. Because they have to dump a bunch of money into R&D to meet these standards. They end up, in some cases, surpassing these standards, and everyone's a winner, right? Everybody gets cleaner cars. The car companies make more money because they're now marketing clean cars, and their whole thing about the doom and gloom about these regulations doesn't ever pan out. Other areas where this is not done, almost all other areas, this is not the case, but the same objections are raised. So This was an open letter, 11 organizations, 11 big organizations, including people like the PEMDA Institute, Canadian Energy Efficiency Alliance, Toronto Atmospheric Fund, Environmental Defense, Architecture Canada, blah, 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 blah. Going, what's really interesting, I mean, A, is to just bring up the fact that this is the easiest thing to do. Efficiency, like this is wasted energy. So even our conservative friends should at least be jumping on board and say, yes, let's not waste money. This seems like a no-brainer, but getting federal regulations in place to defend this stuff is very tricky, and it's not simple. It's not as cut and dry up and down party lines as some other issues, but it still can be very, very tricky. And so what the article is outlining is the types of things can be done. We can in addition to simply creating standards, there's all sorts of financing incentive programs. And what they're talking about is that even when we're talking about financing, it was like, oh, so you want to raise our taxes, is that the way that these things tend to be or specifically could be structured is a way that actually puts all that money back into the hands of consumers, which then spend it locally. So this has been these types of standards changing does have a local economic benefit, not a net loss as well. So we could really dig into the weeds here about what types of things. Just really quickly, one of the things is that in some places in Canada, for instance, Calgary, it's as high as home emissions that could be reduced with current existing technology as high as 55% increase. So more than half of your electricity bill. And of course, here in Ontario, there's some hysteria about hydro prices right now. I think legitimate in some cases, not legitimate in others. But there you go. You could reduce your energy bills by half if we got some regulation in place to force people to, you know, stop kicking and screaming and just go ahead and do this. Consumers are winner. Their energy bills will lower. Companies, even energy sellers, a lot of the time we've had this conversation about, in fact, this plays largely into our series of videos, Stefan, as well, is the whole idea of baseload, right? If you increase efficiency, there's a reduced need for capital investment. And so this can even be good for energy companies, the people who would be normally seen as the person selling the product you're trying to reduce, even they can win here. So we won't do a whole show on this because I really to really get into this, I want to have an engineer or an architect here who can do a better job rather than just synthesizing a journalist article on it. But an important topic for sure. What did you have to say?
I just actually wanted to double like, a couple of names you mentioned there were interesting to me, and then also I wanted to throw out one of my favorite lines ever, which is. Especially this whole energy conversation or energy conservation conversation comes down to a lot in part at least due to homes and autos, and whether they're condominiums or they're personal homes. And Diane Sachs, our Environmental Commissioner of Ontario, has one of these lines that, like, when I first read it, I was like, that's beautiful. I will repeat this forever, and I'm doing it now. Which is at one point early on into her tenure, she said that land use and planning and development is really Ontario's oil sands. Just to underline how much of our GHG emissions come from our land use planning and our inefficient developments that we make. But to sort of put an interesting spin on this, or at least to explain how this can be a story to sort of explain how this can be beneficial to everybody, or how these kind of standards can really raise the bar, is one of the organizations you mentioned in the who's actually pitching this is the Toronto Atmospheric Fund, and they have this fascinating experience. Working with a massive developer, who you'd imagine would be generally against, you know, most regulations, and there's Tridel, who's one of the largest condo developers in the city, and I remember I was talking about a year ago now to someone from the Toronto Atmospheric Fund, and they're telling me this story about how so Toronto actually has relatively strong condo standards now. It's quite recent, but that was a part of and so much that the Toronto then sort of forced Ontario to be relatively good. And now they're now 3-4 years out of date, but they're actually relatively good. And the way that all came about was actually through the Toronto Atmosphere Fund working with Tridel, and they basically helped fund they helped support in this interesting payback system, which I'm not going to get into, but helped fund a whole basically the greenest condo Tridel could build at the time. And just like try to figure this out, do as much as you can, make it as energy efficient as you possibly can. And they went out and did it, and then they proved, and in doing so, it showed that it was doable, and that it wasn't even that. And they ended up actually surpassing, I think, the actual goal targets. And then they took that model and was like, "Look, you can do this." Brought it back to the city of Toronto with the backing of industry, and was like, "We've proven they can be this much more efficient. Let's hold them to this new standard." Mm. And then that is how Toronto's new condominium laws came in place, or not laws, but guidelines or whatever. Mm. And it shows that sort of that these energy efficiency standards are really what they do is that they force the people who have the ability to make them better and have the ability or have the conscience. It's an opportunity for these companies who are able to actually make, you know, to put the investment to do these better buildings to sort of actually to take over the marketplace to some extent. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like if you were willing to play by these standards, it's the same thing about when the coal plants were doing when they were about to get phased out, was that they were hoping they'd get regulated so they could be protected from future things that would eventually actually completely wipe them out.
Yeah, regulate us before you destroy us.
Exactly, yeah. And obviously, housing isn't something you can just get rid of, but at the very least, what it does do is it forces the developers to live to the highest standard, which you can get them to prove they can live to.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how many different interests come into this one thing.
What I think, before we move on, I think there's sort of two important takeaways here. One of them, I was reminded recently of an interview we did with Greening Homes, a local green developer here, just because they retweeted the interview we did like 2 days ago. So one of the things there was the story was that they ended up setting a record for green building standards. I don't remember exactly what the award was for. I think this was Ontario specific or something, so it's not like global or anything. But they set a record, but they didn't set out to. What they set out to do was, we have a budget and we're going to do as much as we can with this budget, and then they ended up like blowing away everybody's expectations, even themselves. They were shocked with the end result. And we have another case here, the one you mentioned with Tridel. And so, I mean, one of the things here, the important thing is, it's amazing what happens when you try.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other thing is, okay, well, why aren't we trying? And you pointed out part of it, but the biggest reason, and this isn't just Toronto, but this is a huge reason to Toronto and Ontario, is as well, is that the problem, the number one problem with this, why aren't they trying? Well, there's a very simple explanation. It's because the people who build the buildings are not the people who operate the buildings in many cases. So the people who build the buildings want to sell the building. They build the building and then they sell it to somebody. If you're going to sell something, you want to sell it for the lowest possible price. There's two ways you can do that. One, all this energy efficiency stuff costs extra upfront money. It saves tons of money down the road, but it has higher upfront costs. The second thing is that developing these plans, this experiment that you were talking about Tridel doing, once you have that design, you can copy and paste it infinitely, right? You can make minor adjustments, but you have to pay people to do that work, and architects, I know a few, are not cheap.
Yes.
So once you have a plan, you just copy and paste it. If you're a developer, you just, I'm just going to use the same shell outline. Why spend another $2.2 million developing a new plan when I have a plan? That's $2.2 million I've just made every time I do a building by not having to redo the plans from scratch. And so they go. And so they build to the lowest common denominator for the plans they already have, plans that are 40 years old that weren't even energy efficient or top of the line at the time, that are now not top of the line and 40 years out of date. And that's what they build. And then the people who would actually reap the benefits, who might want this stuff, those buildings don't exist to buy, right? So what we really have here is a very simple problem. You just put a regulation is where you don't get a choice. You must meet these standards. Everybody does it. And then all of a sudden, like, this is an overnight solution problem. The problem is there's no clear way to do this. And there doesn't appear to be political, like, there's no votes to get by doing this. Where there are, but it's not perceived by politicians that there's votes to get by doing this, even though it's a simple thing that would have massive impacts, which is basically the tagline for every week's show.
Well, and small standards and regulations are not the sexiest of topics.
Mm.
But I'm going to use as a segue to how you can find out or how you can understand that extractive industries are old. Or old technologies, or at least the extractive industries are sort of stuck in the past. Perhaps I'll use, which is these two very. This is a bit of a fluff piece, and I'll admit. But once I got to saw the second one, I just couldn't help myself, because there's two different stories coming out of one from the oil sands and one from the Ring of Fire, the mining space in Northern Ontario, of these absurd advertisements. For the organization. So the one from the Ring of Fire is getting a little more attention, in part because it's actually set up from a much larger mining group, in which two women in bikinis are used to try to sell you on basically mining, on this mining project. And they're explaining those sort of things. And the industry defended it by saying it's sex sells. As if our decisions on whether or not we should do these massive extractive mining techniques and disrupt these different lands, especially like one part of it even has a woman in a bikini explaining like how they're going to reach out to Aboriginal people. And it's like, you know what? Maybe actually reach out to them and don't weirdly sell it to us with a woman in a bikini. This is not. It's just this. It's like the '80s called. Their tactics want them back. Like, stop trying this. Maybe actually just act like humans are humans and talk to them and explain. If you can make a good case for it, you don't need to try to sell us mining with sex.
I actually blame Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah. I blame him because I think he's shocked a whole bunch of people who are big on deceiving the public. And shocked them with the bounds, the outer limits of just how full of it you can be, and how easily swayed a portion of the public is, and the realization that you only need a part of the public to create a controversy about something and muddy the water, right? So people, right wingers have been trying to use that stuff to get elected for a long time. He came right out and instead of whispering about it, just started punching people in the face. And to everyone's amazement, yours and mine included, it's been incredibly successful. And I think a lot of other people who, Trump has literally broken the fact checkers, the thing. There's something about like 98% of his statements were rated as false. Like, I don't even know how that's possible to be that untrue. It would require some effort or some significant talent. But I think people have been paying attention and be like, hey, you know what? Actually, the lowest common denominator is actually lower than even we thought it was. So let's just go for it. And I do. I'm making a serious point here. I do blame Trump for this type of thing sort of coming back up.
That's fair. Well, and part of it also I just think it has to do with this just – this is what happens when you don't know the audience you're trying to win over. Hmm. Like the second one is way worse. It's so bad. And it's from the Canada oil sands community. And there are so many
they're
things,
not at all suspect, are they?
There are so many things about this advertisement that are offensive that I can't even begin to explain. But it's so they're taking off it's taking off from, in part, I guess, what was actually a very long right wing news like sort of the Ezra Levant type, or actually literally Ezra Levant runs a thing of Ethical Oil, which very much was trying to vilify and use racism to vilify other countries, which have dubious – I will not say that they don't have dubious human rights records, but vilify them to make you support the oil sands. And in this one, it just says, in Canada, lesbians are considered hot. In Saudi Arabia, if you're a lesbian, you die. And like –
Can I read this next part?
Yes.
Why are we getting our oil from countries that don't think lesbians are hot?
Like, and then it has this seductive picture of two women kissing. Everything about this is bad. Everything about this is bad.
I think actually the next line is actually the best / worst, like best in the worst category, which is the choose equality, choose Canadian oil.
Yeah.
Like that's, you can't have a more taped together like pair of concepts.
Well, what strikes me about this is that this is decided that, like, it's clear that their goal here – like, the only thing I can understand about this is that I think in their minds they were going to be like, we're going to get support from this by people who care about human rights, and then just basically completely objectify and do everything wrong to make anyone who you weren't already on your side listen to. I can even – like, there's nothing good about this advertisement.
Yeah. As far as it goes here, and we'll let Edward jump in here, who's got a comment as well. But like this to me is like on the level of as far as like things that people who are doing it think are cool compared to how completely offensive it is. This is like on the level of like blackface.
This is a 14-year-old in high school who's just learned that the oil sands exist. And it's like, I'm going to make a whole campaign about it. It's going to be like, this is, I think, ludicrous.
I think
bad.
You've just insulted a lot of 14-year-olds. I might have to go lower.
All right, fair enough.
But let's let Edward jump in.
I think the real flaw in this, though, is yes, in Saudi Arabia, maybe you would die if you're lesbian. I'm not sure on the facts on that. But they never said whether or not Saudi Arabia finds lesbians hot. I don't think that's really covered, and I don't think that's really... Because, like, yes, maybe they would get in trouble if you are a lesbian, but I don't think they can claim that they don't find them attractive.
They do not clarify that. That's true. Yeah.
You've just upgraded this, Edward, to fractally wrong.
Yeah.
Which just
none of that's right.
For those of you who aren't familiar with that expression, fractals are natural patterns that represent each other at every scale. And so fractally wrong means you're wrong at every scale. You're wrong in the details. You're wrong in the big picture. There's every possible conceivable way in which you could be wrong. You're wrong.
Yeah.
This is fractally wrong.
Yeah. So, like, just to minor serious note on this, and then we'll go to the music break, which is just for obvious statements. This is offensive in every single way. To in any way imply, yes, there are human rights concerns in Saudi Arabia, unquestionably. To compare that to whether or not then objectifying, this is literally saying, hey, straight men, this is only for straight men. And it's using an entire subset of people who want to be ignored by you. They don't need you, random straight guy who wants to hear through you. You're not important in their lives.
Yeah. As if we needed another way to cut this up, but just for fun, right before we go here, this will be the last thing on it, would be I would love to, if they really stand behind this argument, and they couldn't possibly, I would say they would have to put out the identical ad with two gay guys kissing.
Someone
and
made
say
that.
Gay guys are hot.
Yeah.
If they can't bring themselves to do that, then I think that's an admission.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, this is sexist, this is homophobic, this is racist, this is I saw it, and very few things make my jaw drop these days. I saw this ad and I was blown away at its tone deafness in every single way.
All right, so Canadian oil sands community faux or grassroots organization, you've just won the Donald Trump Award for this week.
Yes, there you go.
Edward, when are we going to listen to on our first music break?
All right, after one of the silliest ads I've ever seen.
All right, we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. You could be listening on one of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners all across the country, now internationally as well, or on our on Rabble.ca, our friends over there at Rabble.ca. If you're listening to the Green Majority podcast version, however, the version found on our website, you will also find a bonus show in which this week we're going to probably talk about some of our cast-off, some of the tech/science news that we probably won't have time to get to on the show, which may include a conversation about avocados. I haven't decided yet. May talk about some dissolving batteries, perhaps some plastic recycling not being cost effective anymore and its relation to fracking. A whole bunch of really interesting things. There's always way more news than we could possibly get to on the show here that we cover. So listen to the bonus show for that, or as well check the website where I list all the stories, whether we get to them or not, that I dig up for the week. So there we go. But without further ado, unfortunately, it doesn't look like we're going to get Emma Ma today, but we do have her in virtual form. Because MA was down at the Common Bound Conference, which was a organizing conference. And maybe, Stefan, you can provide more information.
It's in Buffalo, New York.
There you go.
From July 8th to 10th. And it's three packed days of discussion and collaboration to drive the new economy.
There you go.
At least if the Google tagline is to be.
MA was down there and invited us to join us as well. Unfortunately, we were unable to go. But she went down there and interviewed a few folks. So we have a few interviews we're going to play from her over the next little while. Right now, what we're going to listen to is a brief interview with Nancy Neimtan from Chatier de l'Economie Sociale. She's the strategic advisor. And Nancy is going to talk about the role of the social economy, both the role it plays and the role it could play if it were more properly supported. So without further ado, here's Emma Ma interviewing Nancy Neimtan.
So I'm here with Nancy Neimtan, the strategic advisor to Chantier de l'Economie Sociale, and we're here on a beautiful day in Buffalo at Common Bound 2016. And I've just come back from hearing Nancy speak in a very interesting conversation at one of the sessions. So, Nancy, first of all, I just want to start off having you speak to our listeners a little bit about what is the social economy?
Well, the social economy can be defined in different ways. When we talk about it from a perspective of an enterprise or an organization, we're talking about collectively owned enterprises, so cooperatives, nonprofits, mutuals, that are within the economy. So they're creating goods, they're creating services, but their ultimate goal is to benefit the community. And they base themselves on certain basic rules, which is putting people over capital and assuring democratic control. So that's when we talk about social economy enterprises. And when we talk about the social economy movement, we're talking about a broader movement of all kinds of people working in all kinds of different organizations and social movements that are working together to create a more democratic and inclusive and sustainable economy.
And perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the Shanti, the organization you work for, and how you work in a supportive way towards the social economy.
It's the Shanti and is an organization that will be celebrating actually its 20th anniversary since its inception, and we've been a formal structure since 1999. And it's a network of networks, the Shanti, that has a mission. Our mission is to promote and develop the social economy as a component of a new economic development model. And so to do that, we brought together people who in different ways aspire to that new economic development model and are actually working to move that agenda forward. So part of our membership and part of our governance structure is made up of networks of social economy enterprises, worker co-ops, housing co-ops, parent-controlled nonprofit daycare, recycling businesses, and so on. Another part of our membership and governance structure is made up of people working in rural and urban communities to revitalize their community for the benefit of their local populations. And then a third major part of our membership is our social movements, the labor movement, the women's movement, the community movement, environmental movement, cultural democracy, all those who again, are aspiring to social transformation and improving the lives of our citizens. Add to that a particular relationship we have with the Assembly, Quebec Assembly of First Nations, that are officially members of our board as well, because they consider that our approach to economic development is very similar and has a lot of intersection with the First Nations vision of the earth, of community, and how our economy should be based on responding to the needs of our planet and the needs of our people.
You had spoken earlier about some of the barriers around people gaining access to capital who want to deliver goods and services that are of benefit to communities, and this perception of risks. Now, how have you worked to address that issue?
Yes, well, obviously, if we were talking about wanting to do economic development, one way or another, one has to deal with money and access to capital, and that's a little bit the problem in the world today, is that those who control capital, and it's a very small number of people, decide how development takes place. So we have been obsessed with the idea of being able to reappropriate and make sure that those who are doing development in communities can control capital. So it's been a learning curve that has started over 20 years ago when we first created our first investment fund that lent non-guaranteed loans, so because we're not asking people to put their future on the table. This is, you know, money that is going into projects because we believe in them, and started to lend money to small co-ops and nonprofit organizations, and have had remarkable success because these enterprises are born out of needs and aspirations. They last, and so there's a long term, and they pay back, and they're responsible. We realized that, you know, small loans, we would go up to $50,000, was interesting, but a lot of these enterprises had more ambitions and greater needs. And so in 2007, we were able to create another financial tool that is called our trust. It's a $53 million fund where we can invest up to $1.5 million in what we call patient capital, which seems to be an oxymoron for those who are supposedly, you know, neoliberal financial experts, because capital is supposed to get in there quick, make a lot of money, and get out. And our idea was to get money in to allow communities to develop in a long process, and that we are very patient in terms of the capital being returned. And now, and these kinds of successes, because they have been successful and they've been able to show that our that our default rate is so low that, you know, you don't have to run after high returns on investment. They can be reasonable financial returns because people are not defaulting. And so we've been able to prove to potential investors, pension funds and others, that this is a good investment. And now we've started to, we're building more and more financial tools for specific sectors, housing, daycare and so on, because we know that this is good investment and because investors are interested in getting involved.
I wondered if you could speak a little bit about your sort of risk management or risk assessment framework, because perhaps you take a different approach to the conventional one. You talked about looking at initiatives that are deeply rooted in the community.
Absolutely. I think one of the first things we learned, and we learned it very quickly, that it's not the people who come in with a fancy business plan that are necessarily going to be the best entrepreneurs and create the best enterprises from our perspective. That on the contrary, what we've learned is we have to analyze the risk involved in these ventures from a totally other lens, which is roots in the community. An enterprise that is a collective enterprise that is well established and supported by the community, its survival rate are extremely high, and so that's the first thing we look at. And if we know that the community is supporting it, even if the business plan is not so good, or even if, you know, there's still the information, we'll lend small amounts of money, we'll support, we'll find ways of helping them to get it to be investment ready, because we know, first of all, and that's our goal, is to invest in enterprises that are responding to needs of communities, but also because we know that if the community is behind it, its survival rate and its chance of success is much higher.
As I understand it, the social economy is about 10% of the economy in Quebec, and you've had some success in terms of engaging policymakers and getting a legislative framework established.
Yes, for many years, and this was one of the first things that we worked on was the whole issue of recognizing that this is a legitimate form of the economy, because neoliberal politicians would very much like to say that the only economy is the stock market and the General Motors and the Bombardiers of this world. And so the issue of recognition was right from the beginning important, so that people knew that this is an option, that this way of developing a human-centered economy could be a tool for them, and getting this into business schools and so on. And we were able to win in 2013 a new legislation that's called framework legislation that was actually adopted unanimously by our National Assembly, that recognizes the social economy as an integral part of our socioeconomic infrastructure, and that requires government to take into account its existence when it develops, public policy in terms of, you know, enterprise support for enterprise investment and so on, that recognizes our organization as one of the privileged interlocutors of government on this issue, and therefore allows us to demand and to fight to have a level playing field, because, you know, the private sector is getting a lot of support for government, and we have shown many times over that the same kind of support, but adapted to the reality and the final goals of a social economy, we can produce better results quicker, and with obviously more results for the common good and for our communities.
So when you think about questions around sustainability and scaling up human-centered economies, say in the national Canadian context, What is your vision for the future around that? How do you think we advance this kind of way of looking at economics and looking at our systems as a country?
Well, we really have to work from a systemic perspective, in the sense that we have some opportunities now with the new federal government that is talking about social finance, they're talking about social innovation, they're talking about social enterprise. The issue is making sure that they're listening to what communities need, as opposed to deciding somehow in some ivory tower what is going to be good for us and for the work that's being done on the ground. But we also have to be working on developing financial instruments. We have to be working on networking, on learning from each other. We have to be into the universities, and this is happening more and more, certainly in Quebec, but I think across Canada, where young people are demanding that their management schools, that their economic departments start talking about this stuff, teach this stuff. And I think that's one of the most exciting things about what's going on in Quebec and in Canada, and I would say around the world, that this is a vision of the future, a sustainable, inclusive economy that we call social solidarity economy that speaks to young people. And so I think that one of the ways of building this economy and is to really work with young people, work within the school system, within universities, to get the word out. But we also need public policy that recognizes and supports this in the same way that, you know, Bombardier and all those other companies have gotten so much support. Well, if we could only get, you know, the same kind of support, I think that we could make, and we've seen it in several occasions in Quebec, how we can make huge leaps forward.
Nancy, thank you so much for speaking to me on this beautiful day in Buffalo.
It's my pleasure.
All right. And so that was M.A. Ma down at the Common Bound Conference. We'll be listening to a couple more interviews that M.A. Produced while she was down there in upcoming weeks. And of course, we'll have links to information about the speaker and the conference itself, which I believe is going to be happening again next year, more than likely, on the website, which you can find at greenmajority.ca. While I mention the website, perhaps Stefan would like to tell us some information about the
about
website.
It? We have a new one.
Hey!
that's the fun thing. I just Instagrammed it, actually, because, you know, because we're hip with the kids.
That's right.
Actually, to be fair, I think I had to Snapchat it to be hip with the kids. So we are not hip with the kids. We're hip with, like, the 27-year-olds, maybe? Yeah. I don't know who uses Instagram.
As usual, for 30-something, I'm, like, 4 years away from being cool.
Right.
So it's like it's not completely out of touch, but like not on the leading edge.
Right. Yeah. Honestly, there's probably something else even that isn't Snapchat that people are on now that I don't even know about, which whatever that is, I could send this out on. But instead, I just Instagrammed it. It's a picture of the front page, at least. It's a brand new website. It has all the same features as the previous website. It's just actually a couple other links. It's a whole new thing. So go check it out. Let us know what you think. Let me know. I just actually, during that interview, I discovered one of the buttons didn't work and fixed it. So let me know if the other buttons don't work so I can fix them. But it has at least, actually, what's great about this website, actually, is that it will allow us to keep some of our archive, at least, consistently on one page.
That's right.
Instead of having to go to multiple different websites to find previous shows, you actually you can go through this website and actually see a bunch of them in a row. So that's an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And also just has some pictures of some of our, has some new pictures of some people, and also if you just miss seeing Kevin Farmer's face,
that's right,
he does show up, which is always an advantage as well. But now it's 11:40. We can go out to music break and then jump back in if you like.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't we do that? I had a few technology things that were tagged there. As well, I even have a couple of thoughts about the interview that we just had, but for the sake of keeping to our schedule, the technology stuff I feel like is the sort of thing that is really good bonus show material. Right. So yeah, why don't we skip right over that? We'll pick a couple of those technology ones to get to in the bonus show as well. Please do make sure you check out this new brand new website though. Aside from seeing Stefan's hard work, it was 100% Stefan putting it together for both credit and criticism. Email Stefan at greenmajority.ca. And we'll leave it there for now. But do go check it out. Check out our new fancy new website, which Stefan worked very hard on. It looks great. Where you will also find links to all of these news stories that there's so far, even at this point in the program, already about 10 that I had flagged that we've skipped over. So lots had going on. Maybe some stuff that you would find more interesting than what we had talked about. I hope that's not the case, but if it is, perhaps check it out. Maybe there was something there that will grab your attention. You can do that at greenmajority.ca. But let's go back to Edward now. And before we go to our music break, this is sadly going to be your last show for a while.
No.
Do you have not a minute of silence? I can give you like 5 seconds of silence. Why don't you maybe say you're going off to greater things? What's going on?
No, not really greater things, no. But
just busy.
Yeah, just busy. Because for me, I go to U of T, and so that's starting up pretty soon, and I've just been busy a lot with work. So I thought it would be a good chance to, kind of move on and try and go to better things, I guess.
Real-life responsibilities.
Yeah, real-life responsibilities.
What are you trying to say about us?
He's hip with the kids.
Yeah. He's too busy on Snapchat.
Yeah, no. But I would like to say, though, I've learned a lot with this show. I didn't come in with a whole lot of knowledge, but I think I've left with a lot more. And it's made me definitely more socially aware, and I always enjoyed doing the show. And I hopefully will be coming back once in a while, or possibly if things open up for me, I may even come back full time. But at least Alex is here, and you know he'll produce a very nice show. You won't have as many blips and weird cutoffs and stuff. So, but yeah,
we also won't hear songs from way back.
Yeah,
I know.
No way back
I
songs.
I knew we had to get the way back in there on the no, show. We had to get the way back reference.
Not as much classic rock. it's gonna be different.
So, right. So what is the song that you're gonna use to play yourself out?
I am gonna play. I thought this was pretty like. Kind of good. It's The Spirit of the Radio by Rush. So it's classic rock. It's an oldie, and it's kind of like radio themed.
Well
so
done.
There you
I
go.
Thought it was good.
All right.
All right. Here it is. Spirit of the Radio by Rush.
All right. We're back. We're now into the final section of the Green Majority Radio program. You are listening on CIUT 89.5 FM or possibly on one of our wonderful and very appreciated radio partners, international radio partners as well, or on rabble.ca, another great place you can listen to the show. Or you can get the extended version of the show with a bonus show at greenmajority.ca, where you can also check out our brand new website. Without further delay, however, we have our international section there, loosely called international section here at this point. I have a brief story of intrigue here, meant in the literal sense, I guess, or in the best sense, I guess, of intrigue, which international intrigue. Here, just really quickly touching in the UK. So there's a bit of a kerfuffle right now. I'm using the word kerfuffle because there's like 40 articles about this on just the Guardian website alone. But I actually missed the original story. But there was an American dual citizen, American Chinese, who was working on in some capacity in the U.S. With nuclear technology,
but he was also then working out of Hinckley's is in the UK.
Yeah, so I'm not clear. No, so the Hinckley, the power plant. So the it's a confusing story. I had to read three articles about this to actually understand. So what happened was this guy was arrested on espionage charges for trying to circumnavigate the rules about exporting nuclear secrets in the U.S. He is a top official, was there sort of on behalf of a Chinese state-sponsored company, which is a tangent we could take because Chinese state-owned companies also have huge investment in the oil sands. And we reported years ago that they had at one point had more than 51% share in the oil sands. So I don't know if that's still true. It was at one time true. So that's sort of the minor Canadian connection here. But essentially what happened was this is the company that he worked for is the same company that has a 1/3 involvement in a giant Hinckley Point nuclear plant that was stated to be built in the U.S. In the U.K. with the 1/3 ownership from this Chinese state-owned company. So because the company is sort of through this in America was charged with espionage, now there's heat on the UK government to drop the project because they're concerned about having the same company involved with their nuclear program. However, it's a little bit stickier than that because if it seems like that's a bit of a loose connection, it does really feel that way. So it feels like there's some three-dimensional sort of behind-the-scenes political chess here taking place as well, because of course we have a brand new UK government that's also coming in. So there's a lot going on here, and I think we're gonna have to wait a little while for the dust to settle. I'm not even gonna go in any further into it just because there seems like there's still so much in the air here. But the reason I flagged it at all was I enjoy stories of intrigue. any article with the word spy in it is gonna grab my attention.
Oh yeah, exactly. We can just do a spy show.
Yeah, well, we could and should. Well, we'll put a note on that.
See, if CIT lets us do a second hour, it will be all spy stories all the time.
Stefan will be the producer for that book. So the only link here I think I could make before we move on was just the idea that this is I think further legitimacy to the idea of propagating power as a thing and why we should be focused on power that is not easily transferred to weapons is that we wouldn't have this problem if the UK was building a $18 billion tidal facility or solar facility. And just another reason why both oil and gas and nuclear have huge, huge downsides is the, in nuclear's case, the weaponization. And we wouldn't even be having these conversations. There wouldn't be a problem if we weren't talking about these power types. And it does play into weapons conversations. And I think that too often gets left off, not from the activist sides by any means. That's sort of their main point here, or one of their main points is the nuclear waste and the fact that this presents both native terrorist targets and the exportation of nuclear waste to make things like dirty bombs is a legitimate concern here. And we have some of that concern now playing out in international politics as well, potentially affecting the relationship between not only the further sort of muddying the relationship between the U.S. and China, but also now between the U.K. and China as well. But I think that's all the time we'll spend on that for now. Stefan.
Yeah, so I'm going to make the great leap from nuclear spies to avocados.
Avocados. Avocado
is,
spies.
Avocado spies, which is a story it's one of those things where every once in a while you get a new story about, like, this new thing that everyone is eating is causing untold damage other places. And this is another one of them.
No, the first story is that it's a superfood that cures cancer.
Right.
The second story is that it's now being mass produced in such quantities that it's tearing up rainforest.
Right, yeah. And the third one is that local populations that used to rely on this food are now no longer able to afford it because it's cost more to export. And so now they're eating other things and it's worse.
Yeah. And finally, it turns out the reports were greatly exaggerated and it wasn't that good for you in the first place. That is the complete cycle of those news stories.
Except that you are now still eating it forever.
That's right.
So you're welcome, quinoa. and I was moved on to avocados, which to be fair, are a little less hyped.
That's right. Yeah, they're legitimately
so
good.
Delicious.
Yes.
So the story here really is that Mexico is actually having this larger problem with as the increase of demand for avocados increases, so it started in the United States. And it was funny. It's like, quite honestly, with guacamole for the Super Bowl, and that was enough to, like, you know, everyone learned that avocados were delicious, and Mexicans were like, yeah, we know, we've had them forever. But then the Americans were like, no, seriously, guys, these are really good. And they're like, no, we've had them forever, but we'll pay you way more money for it.
And really importantly here, and I think you actually just misspoke, but there's not necessarily – the biggest connection isn't necessarily to demand, is that price is going up. And the reason price is going up is because of climate change. They're harder and harder to grow. So it's actually a supply-side issue to why price is skyrocketing. And the increased price from a supply – so it's all connected. Yes, right, you weren't wrong, but I think the highest point of the article was about – unless I'm wrong, was that the cost was going up, and that cost was going up due to the fact that their production was down.
So avocado production is not down. That is, at least maybe down the last couple of years, but between 2000 and 2001 and 2010, avocado production in one part of Mexico called Micoacán?
You're trying to mispronounce
something. Yeah, exactly. tripled. But what's interesting is that the price the production tripled, but exports rose 10 times. Suddenly a lot of the food that was staying in area is now being exported out. And that's according to a report published in 2012 by Tapia Vargas Institute. And that is only a part of the larger concern that's the United States demand. Avocado demand in China is increasing by about 200% every year. And so as soon as that demand hits the market, these prices are increasing further. And if you want to know why that matters, it matters because suddenly people are now trying to basically hide growing avocados everywhere. It's estimated that about 700 hectares of forests were lost in a year in Mexico between 2000 and 2010 to this avocado production. And so much so that, like, apparently you are even seeing forests that look like forests but have avocados hiding in the underbrush because of this fact. And so all of this is to say that eating in season and local has added benefits, including not destroying a ton and ton of forests that exist in places like Mexico.
Right. Well, yeah, and without getting into with it too much, I want to get to one more thing here before the end of the show. But the thing there too is, I mean, and this is actually something you've brought up before repeatedly, Stefan. This idea about, well, you just there is just things you're just not going to be able to have in this climate changed world, and you just have to accept that this means certain things. Like, you don't get to do that anymore,
or at least that you have to pay more for it. It has to stop being an everyday thing and start being like an actual treat, right? And if you've ever grown food in your own backyard, you understand how much better fresh things are anyways, or if you've ever had a mango off the tree rather than shipped all the way up here, you know the value of eating local.
Right, and it's the difficulty, but it's a similar thing to, you know, my famous occasionally good but go to them no matter what 100% of the time whether good or not metaphors. Is the idea of like having like a tray of chocolate cake, and you're hungry, and say there's four slices left. Well, one slice would satiate you, but there are four in existence. But that doesn't mean you have to eat all four. But whether or not you want one, you know, whether or not you're hungry and you need to eat one, let's say, because that's the only food around, and whether you have the ability technically to eat four, at some point you'll run out, right? There, you could not, under any circumstances, eat more than four. And so what the comparison I'm trying to make here is that the idea that due to climate change, and whether it be climate change reducing the supply side, which is mixed into all of this as well, right? And without getting sidetracked, coming back to what we were saying. So I was talking about the idea that because of climate change, each hectare of land will produce more avocados. So to increase production, you have to increase more and more the rate of area that you have to grow them. And that's what you were talking about, has to grow and grow. But like at some point, there's just going to be a limit. And the climate change impacts will keep raising. Prices will keep raising. The ability to find more land to grow them will run out. And there's an upper limit to just how much we can produce. And eventually, the market will have to contract, right? It doesn't matter what market you're talking about. It can't sustain explosive growth, right? And at some point it will contract. And so the thing here is also doing this is that, you know, there's so many side effects from having these, you know, boom and bust cycles of certain types of crops, is that it destroys the land, it makes it terrible to plant, it eats up all this rainforest. So, okay, so if we understand that at some point there's going to be a thing, whether we do anything or not, whether we have any willpower or not, there's only four slices of cake. Mm-hmm. So we know a stopping or reducing consumption is non-optional. If we know that, and we know that maybe having one more avocado and not four, or we're having one slice of cake and not four, is now there's we're going to have to stop. What, you know, having the willpower to stop at that first slice, and having the willpower to say, you know what, I'm just not going to eat things that don't come from my local thing before they're taxed, you know, in a way that said to make it that it's not negotiable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the trick here, because, you know, we can talk about we want these regulations, but they're not going to come through because it's very difficult to get them because there's market demand. But at some point, it has to come down to just consumers saying, I'm not going to purchase that. Do they have the willpower?
Well, not only that, when you've seen it, what's interesting about that is that if you're basing your eating habits off trying to find the cheapest food possible, and that's how you're budgeting your time out, you're setting yourself up to be hit by these market shocks. Whereas if you're already eating things that sort of are, you know, that are already priced a little higher because they're local and because they're so locally sourced, you have the ability, you won't feel the market shocks because they aren't the things not being affected right now. And so I think if you're to budget yourself into expecting, you know, again, and there's a huge other conversation here about food security and requirements of governments to actually be able to support citizens and actually being able to afford these food increases, because that's a massive part of this and has to be part of the conversation. But as far as like people, you know, who are buying avocados, because avocados are luxury food, no matter how for anyone here in Canada, if you're at least focusing on purchasing things that are local or at least sustainably sourced, you can be assured that your price isn't going to increase as much when these market shocks do hit you.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we did eat up our time with that, despite my best efforts. But yeah. I think being clear on the few things we do talk about is better.
Shotgunning
as many, you know, as many things as possible.
Yeah.
So we're basically out of time here. We will have a bonus show, though. We're going to talk about any or all of the following on the bonus show: dissolving batteries, synthetic leaves that are 10 times more efficient for natural synthesis than natural leaves, and the idea that the Green Party could shoot over the NDP as sort of leading up as being closer to being something resembling an official opposition and getting market share based on the idea of proportional representation. Any or all of those will be discussed on the bonus show if you're listening to the podcast. Other than that, have a good green week, folks. Thanks for listening to The Green Majority, and take care. We'll talk to you all real soon.